You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Bruna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast,
Mystery of Everything,
available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to All Creatures Podcast. I'm Angie, and today we will be talking all about the incredible octopus and their shape-shifting and mastermind behavior with my special guest, Dr. Alex Schnell, who is a marine biologist researcher and National Geographic host. Dr. Schnell has spent her career exploring the complex memory of the octopus, and she is here today to share her passion about cephalopods and to tell us more about her new Nat Geo series she is hosting called Secrets of the Octopus, which is premiering on Earth Day on Nat Geo. As we celebrate Earth, the oceans, and people working to understand and conserve the species that inhabit the oceans, I'm just so very happy to have Dr. Schnell on the podcast today, helping us learn more and get really excited about octopus behavior. So hello, Dr. Schnell. Thank you for being here today. It's so nice to see you.
Thank you, Angie. Thanks so much for having me. I'm super excited to be chatting about octopuses with you today.
I know. I just love them. We've covered them a little bit on the podcast. I know we have an older episode about the blue-ringed octopus, but every time we dive into them in the podcast, it's just, they're literally mind-blowing. They're like aliens. So I'm just really happy to learn more, and I was blessed enough to have a little sneak peek of some of the episodes and have been like re-falling in love with octopus this whole week, late at night, eating my popcorn, just mind blown. So we're going to get to all that in a little bit, but first, can you give our listeners a little bit about your background and how you got here today?
Sure. I've always been intrinsically interested in the ocean. I was really lucky in that I grew up on the beaches in Sydney. And so I just always had my head in a rock pool. And I think from a very young age, I wanted to go into marine science. And so I studied to be a marine biologist and then became completely captivated by cephalopods, the cuttlefish, squid, and octopus. And then the more I learned about them, the more I became interested in their minds. So I started specializing in comparative psychology, which essentially means we just compare different animal minds. And I specialize in marine minds.
Wow, that I love animal behavior and intelligence, always my favorite little section when I teach it in class. Unfortunately, I only get about a week to do it. And that's does not do it justice. So it's such a fascinating topic. And I feel like we're learning so much about it. And we'll definitely dive more into that. But I was wondering, when you were growing up on the beaches and just always in the water, do you remember having like an aha moment of like the octopus or definitely the ocean versus the shark or elephants? Do you have an aha moment you'd like to share?
I do. It was at the very rock pool that I used to spend all my time with that I had my first encounter with an octopus. Mm. And I think that really set my trajectory to end up so intimately involved with them. So I would spend a lot of time in these rock pools, usually looking for sea hares. Do you know what that is?
No.
Oh, it's actually a relative of the octopus. So it's just like a giant sea slug. And the reason they get their name sea hare is because they look like they have little rabbit ears. So I love them as well, and they're just so adorable. But that's what I was looking for when I came across two really large eyes with rectangular pupils. So that's what an octopus has, rectangular pupils. And I was a little nervous at first because I would have only been five or six. But I spent, you know, a lot of time just observing this critter. And then before I knew it, she reached out a suckered arm to make contact. And it was just so incredible. It was this ET moment that I had.
Gosh, the visual on that is incredible. And we do, little spoiler alert, we do get to see a little bit of that in some of the episodes. So it's just incredible. And besides them reaching out a tentacle to investigate, for lack of better words, do you have a favorite interaction story from all your research and all your years of diving where it was just unbelievable, or just that moment underwater once you're a researcher that just gives you goosebumps to think about to this day?
Oh, there's so many. It's really hard to kind of zone in on one. I think every interaction that I have with an octopus, it takes my breath away. It's so fascinating to me that a creature that has, that is so extremely vulnerable because they have no shell, no claws, no teeth to protect themselves. And yet that extreme vulnerability is often outweighed by curiosity if you spend enough time with them. And, you know, these are wild animals we have, we're interacting with and we're filming in Secrets of the Octopus. And here they are wanting to make contact with a species that's 10 times larger than them. Like, it's very rare for a wild animal to do that.
Correct. Yes. Very, very rare. Very rare. And consistently, like, I mean, it's something that through other documentaries and researchers that is, you're not alone in having that interaction. So yeah. I promise we're going to touch more on their behavior. But I also am curious, as a researcher, can you share with us a little bit about your research background, the octopus species that you have studied, and what your current research and activities and interests are?
Sure. So I primarily look at learning and memory in cephalopods. A lot of my work has actually been based on cuttlefish, and that's because sometimes they can just be a little easier to work with. Octopus can be a little bit temperamental. And while cuttlefish also have personalities, I feel like the personality spectrum in octopus is extreme. You have some individuals that love to interact with you and some that just want nothing to do with you. And so that can be a little bit difficult when you're trying to collect behavioral data. So a big chunk of my work has used cuttlefish instead, and I've looked at different types of learning ability, different types of memory, and also self-control. So a few years ago, I adapted a marshmallow test. I don't know if you know what that is, the Stanford marshmallow test.
I'm familiar with it, but if you could remind our listeners, that'd be great.
Sure. So in the 1970s, some researchers at Stanford University wanted to test whether children could delay gratification. And so they were offered a single marshmallow and told that if they didn't touch it and they waited 15 minutes, they would then be offered two marshmallows. And so what was found is that children below the age of four really, I mean, there was a lot of variation, but a lot of them struggled to wait that 15 minutes. And so this experiment has been adapted quite a bit to study self-control in different animals, but we'd never really looked at it in a cuttlefish or in an invertebrate, really, not using this type of test. Okay. And so I adapted it. Obviously, I didn't offer cuttlefish marshmallows. I offered them different types of shrimp. But I was really shocked. I think I was expecting, and I'm always surprised at their capacities, really, their level of sophistication. But I think I was expecting to see, you know, self-control in terms of they could wait a matter of seconds, which is what you see in a lot of rodents and pigeons.
And myself included.
But I had individuals waiting for up to 2.5 minutes. And so some of the scores that they got were more comparable to great apes and crows. And so it was really phenomenal seeing that that sort of wait time, especially for an invertebrate that lives such a short life.
That is so incredible. And I remember when I was studying and learning more about octopus prepping for one of our older episodes, one of the researchers I was reading was expressing him or herself and just saying that with octopus intelligence, it's almost, we're not smart enough to be able to figure out how to test them because we're looking at through it with such a mammalian lens. And that our traditional tests that we use on toddlers and the dogs or ravens or whatever are just not sufficient. And we're potentially missing the boat because that they're too smart and we just can't figure out how to test them. And so I just always think about that. And I really appreciate the work that you're doing and of course, sharing your passion with us through this new series to give people a little bit more insight just into how complex, how smart, how social they are, and that we do need to study and learn more about them and help thus protect them, because I think you're just at the tip of the iceberg. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, and you're absolutely right. It reminds me of a title of a book by Franz de Waal. He wrote a book a few years ago, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? And you really do have to think outside the box when you're thinking about how am I going to test, you know, the IQ of an octopus. Imagine if you had 8 arms with each arm covered in 200 suckers. Imagine if you had 20 million different pigment cells in your skin and you were able to change color in a fifth of a second. And imagine if you tasted the world with your arms and you had 3 hearts and blue blood. So it is really hard. And I think, like I said, you have to really try and... What I try and do when I design a intelligent test is I try and get into the mind of the octopus in terms of their ecology. What type of ability would they need to evolve to be able to navigate their challenging world? You know, what would be advantageous for them to have in order to find different foraging paths or avoid predators or find a mate or be able to remember how to get back to their den. And so I think when you start designing tests that are ecologically valid, that's when you're more likely to find what you're looking for.
Yeah. And there's so many amazing facts in footage in the film, which we'll talk about, or in the series, which we'll talk about, that's never been seen before, and really exciting things. But you've mentioned a few of them about the blue blood and the number of hearts, but could you just give our listeners, if they're not as familiar with octopus physiology, some fun facts about them? And then even more importantly, why should the public care about octopus and want to help them?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, an octopus, sometimes if you're not familiar with what they look like, you don't really know what you're looking at. So it kind of looks like their body looks like a bit of a floating bag. And then they have 2 very large eyes. And then straight away, like at the base of their eyes, you'll get 8 flowing arms. They have a donut-shaped brain that's wrapped around their throat. They have a beak like a parrot. And, 3 hearts, blue blood. So you could not get more alien. They look very, very different. And And sorry, I've missed the second.
Oh, well, just with all their crazy and alien physiology, why should people care and want to learn more about them and hopefully want to conserve them?
Well, I think it's funny because I think now we are at the golden age of octopus. You know, I was speaking to the author of the book that complements the series, Sy Montgomery, and she was saying when she wrote her first book, and she was starting to do research for her first book, Soul of the Octopus, in 2011, there was hardly anything out there. And now it's a completely different landscape. And I think people are really attracted to octopus because they offer this beautiful balance between otherness. They're so alien, but then also the more we learn about them, especially their cognitive abilities, we're finding familiar traits. And so that it's a balance between otherness and sameness. And so while initially I think we were drawn to the otherness, as more research gets published, we're just finding points of connection where we're like, oh, I have that. I have the ability to, you know, use different types of memory to remember, you know, my past movements. Or now they're looking at octopus sleep and their
dreams. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, you know, there is research to show that humans feel more empathy and compassion towards animals that are more closely related to us. And the more we move along the evolutionary tree, we just feel a little less compassionate. It's like, oh, that's very different. But I think we're in this beautiful point in time where we can shift perspective with the more knowledge that we gain. And that's exactly what's happening in the octopus space. You know, we're revealing their secrets and people are just finding out all these incredible facts about an animal that they just couldn't fathom, you know, had the emotion, had the capacity to feel emotions, to potentially dream, to remember, to problem solve, to use tools. And so I hope, you know, the one thing that can be taken out of Secrets of the Octopus is that it shifts our perspective. And even though they are very different, it can remove this barrier of otherness so that we can feel more empathy and compassion and love for these creatures. And, you know, humans protect what they love.
Absolutely. No, very well said. And because I had the privilege, I will definitely say privilege and honor of doing a little previewing of the series, I must say that this film and you as a host and a diver and a researcher really brought us into the lives of several different individual is it octopi or octopuses or what do we use for the plural?
This is a good question. It is actually octopuses, even though that sounds a little odd. And the reason being is that it's not a Latin derived word. It's actually a Greek derived word. So, yeah.
Okay. So, but multiple octopuses are followed in a really intimate view of just their daily life and their activities. And of course, their intelligence. And so it's just breathtaking. And we'll talk a little bit more in details, but Dr. Schnell, without giving too much of the series away, of course, can you give us a little bit of background on National Geographic's The Secret of the Octopus and what is it about, how many episodes there are, and the overreaching goals of the series?
Of course. So it's a little different, I guess, from the previous Secrets of franchise because, you know, we first had Secrets of the Whales and Secrets of the Elephants, and I think the whole overarching theme for that, for those two series was, oh, look, they're so similar to us. You know, they're social like us. They show these really strong emotions. They have culture. And we couldn't shoehorn the octopus series into that sort of framework because they are so different. It's a three-part series and we first talk about their shape-shifting abilities in episode one and then their intelligent abilities. Episode two is called Masterminds. And then in episode three, we do reveal even a little bit more, even though I think predominantly myself included, always thought octopuses were solitary and they don't show a social behavior. But what this film, this series really shows is that they're more social than we once thought. And I'm not talking about sociality in the way that, you know, chimpanzees form alliances or parrots form partnerships. They're not social so much with one another. We did find instances where there are habitats where you might find, not to reveal too much, but 100 individuals in one spot, and they're tolerating each other. You know, they're not all walking around arm in arm, but they're tolerating each other, which is pretty mind-boggling considering that, you know, there's cannibalism can occur and fighting can occur, and usually they don't like to be around, you know, they're kind of loners in that sense. But there are instances of that. And then we saw, I think what this series really showed is that maybe we're thinking about sociality in the wrong way when it comes to octopus, because what we do find is they show other different social traits. We see collaborative partnerships between octopus and fish species when they're going hunting. And we see these social bonds, these relationships that they make with humans. And it still baffles me. You know, my scientific mind is like, what? I don't know how to explain this, but I think, you know, I theorize that perhaps it's because they don't have, you know, they're basically born orphans. They don't have parents to guide them. They don't form any kind of relationships with siblings. They hatch from their egg and then they just go swim out into the ocean. And from, you know, from that stage, they're alone. But they live very short lives and they have to learn really quickly. And I think it's advantageous for them to try and seek out these learning experiences. And so their drive for curiosity must be very high. And so that's the only kind of explanation I can give at this point before, you know, at this time, we don't know too much, but that drive for curiosity might be the reason as to why they're seeking out interactions with other species.
Yeah, it's just incredible. I mean, the close-up footage and the shots in this documentary are breathtaking. The drones are great too, of course, looking at the water and the islands and things like this. But I mean, their eyes, you mentioned their rectangular eyes in the intro. But just, I felt like I was in the room and in there. And I'm just wondering if you can share some insights on how you captured such these intricate and intimate moments, like courtship displays and awesome, awesome feeding behaviors. And how long did you guys film to get all of this? And then lastly, where did you film?
Yeah, no, good question. I think as we were chatting to the TCA on the panel yesterday, and we had a question about what type of new technology we were using underwater. And the series doesn't really showcase new technology. What was really at the core of this project was trying to capture those intimate moments so that our audience members are going to feel like they're right there feeling that connection. Like, I want people to get goosebumps from those moments. And that took a lot of patience and time. And kudos to the film crew that we had, because they were there. You know, I was there for 20% of the time, but they would turn up and they would acclimatize to the environment, let the animal habituate to them. And it depends on the individual. Like, some individuals were bold and they would want to come and interact after a few hours, after a few days, but others it would take weeks. And so some of the crew, we would fly to a location and spend 6 weeks with certain individuals, and then that's when all the magic happened. It's like the octopuses would be like, okay, you know, you're not a threat, and I'm just going to come out and, you know,
do my thing and show you everything.
Yes. So it did take a lot of patience, but then, like I said, they just throw you in times where, I think my first time I turned up, my first day on the Great Barrier Reef, on Lizard Island with the day octopus, I was just, I could not believe how many octopus were interacting with me. They were just everywhere. And they were so unfazed. You know, after spending an hour with them, they'd want to make contact. And that's a really important thing. I would never initiate the contact.
Of course. Yeah.
The privilege of just watching them and looking at all the wondrous details, that's enough for me. And some of them didn't want to make contact, and that was fine. But they would let me come for swims with them while they were hunting, which was also incredible because you see how they hunt. You know, we captured courtship for the first time.
Yes. Yes. That was incredible.
Yes. And this male was like dancing and trying to impress this female. And it was just so incredible. And it was, the whole sequence was so funny because the female was not keen at the beginning, and she was kind of like slapping him away every time he tried to like push his specialized arm towards her. Because I'm not sure if the listeners know, but one of the male's arms is actually the penis. It's a specialized arm that releases packets of sperm, and he has to insert that into the female's body. And so she wasn't having any part of it.
She was not pleased.
Yeah. And it's also a little bit scary because, you know, you never know how these encounters between two octopuses is going to turn out. So I was like, is he going to try and hurt her? Is he going to try and eat her? You just don't know. But then, yeah, he put on quite a performance and she changed her mind. And that was really cool. In terms of, yeah, so we filmed on every continent except for Antarctica.
Wow.
And that's because you'll find octopuses in every ocean. There's over 300 species, and they have just really, yeah, adapted to every different type of temperature, every different type of habitat. And the way we chose, we feature about 12 species in the series, but we really focus on 8. And, you know, we show stronger profiles of 8 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we chose them was really, we try to choose species that show really visually appealing behavior.
Right.
That could perform on camera, that, you know, if there's a species that only really communicate through chemicals, then that's not going to be very entertaining.
Right.
So we really wanted to engage our audience with, the characters. And so that was a really important part of choosing which species, you know, which would be good in front of the camera.
Yeah. I mean, the species selection was really perfect. I mean, I was all in as with them as individuals watching the courtship displays that male was doing. Yeah. It was so well executed on film. But knowing enough about animal behavior, I know that it probably took a long time to get those shots. So kudos to you, your patience, your diligence, and your team, because bringing that to us as the viewer, I think really does help their personalities come alive, their intelligence, their feelings, right? It's very, very well done. And one of my take home, shots was there was tools being used and really in-depth problem solving. So I was just wondering, Dr. Chanel, if you could elaborate a little bit on some of the more fascinating examples mm-hmm. of the octopus intelligence that you observed during this series.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've worked with cephalopods for 15 years and I still feel so shocked with the level of sophistication that they show. And this one particular day, we were out in Lembe Strait in Indonesia. And this habitat is very different in that it's barren. It's like an underwater desert. And so there's really nowhere to hide. And so different species of octopus that live in this area have come up with different strategies. And one particular octopus, the coconut octopus, kind of walks around collecting different types of objects, including coconuts, but also mm-hmm. shells, and carries them around as mobile dens, kind of like an RV.
So, it's so cute. Yeah.
Yeah. So like we knew that this was happening. It had been documented before, and I'd only ever read about it in a paper, so it was still absolutely fantastic to see it in person. But then this one afternoon, I witnessed this octopus have, she imagined herself an idea, and that was just such a beautiful moment because it really offered a window into the octopus mind. She was being, I guess, challenged by a mantis shrimp.
Harassed, yeah.
She was being harassed, and she was kind of sitting in the sand, being harassed. And for those of you that don't know, mantis shrimp, they have a really mean punch, and it's like faster than a bullet, and yeah, it can be lethal. And so, and octopus, they're soft, they don't have a shell, and so imagine getting a mantis punch to the belly. So she was like trying to make herself look really big, trying to like, she was like blowing sand at this mantis shrimp. And then it's like she just had this aha moment, and she came up with this solution to this problem that she was having. So she lifted herself up out of this sand den that she had created, swam past the mantis shrimp, picked up this shell, and she had imagined herself a shield. She just like put it in front of her body and was carrying it as a shield, and then like took it back past the mantis shrimp, and then was like trying to propel sand, but she had this protection of this shield. And it was, I mean, you can't hear it in the series, but I was screaming underwater because I just couldn't believe what was
happening.
Yeah. And it was just such a beautiful moment of just seeing how intelligent these creatures are in this wild setting. And there's still so much more to learn. Like like you said, we're only just scratching the surface.
Yeah. It's just, I mean, it's just mind boggling. And like I said, the footage, I was eating the popcorn. I was really, really into it. It's just great. To all the listeners out there, I cannot recommend the series enough. You've been blessed enough to get to share your passion and, of course, your research and your skill set with all of us as viewers, as a National Geographic host. And Dr. Schnell, I was wondering if you could touch on what you're hoping that the viewers will walk away after this series. Like, what's the one take-home message that you'd like to speak? To speak in octopus, I guess, if they had to give a message, what would that be?
So I think I would say that the take home from this series that I hope the audience can take is that we're finding glimmers of intelligence in the most unexpected characters. And so what I hope is that this is really going to revolutionize the way that we think about animal intelligence. Because for the longest time, we've always thought of primates as the pinnacle of the intelligence tower. And, you know, a lot of the studies initially when the field of comparative cognition emerged focused on primates. They're most closely related to us, so that's where we looked. And then we started looking at, you know, other mammal groups like elephants and cetaceans, and then we were surprised when we then started looking at large brain birds like crows and jays and parrots and finding these points of familiarity there. But without really extending out and looking at diverse animals, we're not getting a complete picture of the puzzle of how intelligence evolved, why did it evolve, when did it evolve? And so we really need to start looking at animals that are really different from us and seeing what they're capable of. And then in terms of, so that's, I guess, from an academic standpoint, it's really important to complete, to allow us to get a more comprehensive understanding of the evolution of intelligence. But I think it also, the series has implications for ethics and welfare as well, because, you know, a lot of countries are only just starting to recognize invertebrates, so animals without a backbone, as having the capacity to feel pain. And when we put that information out there, that has implications for how we treat them. Mm-hmm. And so a few years ago, I was involved in a group where it was led by a researcher based at London School of Economics, Jonathan Birch, but we researched over 300 papers to see if we could find any evidence of sentience, which is just the capacity to feel. And we found really strong evidence for sentience in octopus and also in cuttlefish and squid. And that ended up changing the law in the UK. So now they're recognized as sentient beings, and that has implications for how we treat them and the kind of welfare laws around any practices that involve cephalopods. And so, yeah, I think, yeah, the main message is that our planet, you know, we share the planet with a lot of diverse minds, and primates are not the only ones that are showing glimmers of intelligence. We're finding it all around us. And I hope that's going to shift perspectives and also change our behaviors.
Yeah. And this is really fascinating in the documentary, talking about how octopus are like dinosaurs, basically. And as far as from how long they've been around, and obviously they've evolved somewhat. But when we think about that type of intelligence for that long, it's just really, I think we're just scratching the surface. And so when there is Secrets of the Octopus 2, and you get all the funding in the world because you're getting to do your dream research, what are some of the questions you'd like to ask next, and areas of research you want to continue exploring with the octopus?
Mm-hmm. Well, I do have a project that has been greenlit to look at. So I've looked at a lot of learning and memory in cephalopods. And I guess one question that I still really have is that, can octopus use their memory to plan ahead? And so when we see, like we've seen it in chimpanzees, and we've seen it in crows and jays, that these animals that can remember specific details about past memories can use that in order to plan for a future scenario.
Right.
But outside of, you know, that group of birds and humans and apes, we haven't seen planning ahead in any other animals. So I want to really kind of investigate that question. That's my next step. And then following from that, I think one area that really intrigues me, and I really hope to try and get some funding for this aspect, is I mentioned that a couple of years ago I was part of the project where we looked at all these studies to see if octopuses can be deemed sentient. But a lot of the research in that area is focusing on negative emotions, because it has the greatest impacts for welfare. You know, can they feel pain? Can they feel anxious? Can they get stressed? Can they get depressed? But a huge area that has been completely ignored is, can animals feel positive emotions? Mm-hmm. And I think that's just as important to be able to benefit their welfare, because you don't want to just say, oh, let's put an animal in this enclosure and make sure that we have nothing that's going to initiate negative emotions for this animal. But what about, how can we make that animal feel joy and comfort, and what positive emotions can we initiate? And so that's still, we have no idea. And, you know, positive emotions isn't something that's been looked at in many animals, but I would love to focus on octopus for that area of study.
Well, I hope somebody listening is ready to give that multi-million dollar grant. That's for sure. Because you touched on some very good points, and more data that we need, for sure. What you were able to film in this series is just so incredible and eye-opening, and we need more of it. But with that being said, you mentioned, Dr. Snell, that there's a couple hundred species of octopuses worldwide in all the oceans. And so what are some of the main global threats that octopus are facing? Is it climate change? Is it ocean health? So what are some of their threats, and on this Earth Day celebration, or Earth Week, Earth Month, it should be Earth Year celebration, and ocean. What is being done to help protect the octopuses from these threats?
It's so sad to say, we just don't know. We don't even, there's so little information on this area that we don't even, as far as I'm aware, I don't even think that any species of octopus has been deemed vulnerable or threatened, because we just don't know. I know that in terms of their physiology, they're highly sensitive to changes in salinity and pH. Temperature can really affect their appetite. And then in terms of, they're a really important part of the food chain. That, you know, they're not apex predators. They're not bottom feeders. They sit right in the middle. Mm-hmm. Essentially, they're a big ball of protein. Anything in the ocean wants to eat them. So they're a really important food source for a lot of predators in the ocean. But at the same time, they're ravenous predators themselves. And so they just keep a beautiful balance in this intricate food web, marine food webs. But yeah, in terms of global threat, we just really don't know. I think one big threat that's happening at the moment is talks of, well, you know, it started the octopus farming project in the Canary Islands, and this project is saying that it's going to release, you know, the pressure of wild stocks, but we know from other aquaculture industries that doesn't necessarily, that's not a result of creating these aquaculture farms. If anything, it means that a lot of the demand for the food product increases, which means puts more pressure on wild stocks. And my main concern with farming octopus is that there's just currently no ethical way to do it. There's no ethical way to euthanize them in that sort of setting. They don't like living in close proximity to one another. So putting a bunch of octopuses together in, you know, a small aquarium, it's just not ethical.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and like you said, I mean, we need more data, and we need to understand this more before we just start doing stuff.
Yeah.
But we all know that our oceans are in crisis, and thus several species that live within the oceans. And so from your point of view, you've dove and been in some of the most remote and stunning places in the world. This, like I said, some of the drone footage on the secrets of the octopus are just, it's incredible. So what's some of your advice on how we can help protect the octopus, protect the oceans, and then ultimately, because it's all intertwined, ourselves?
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a really important part of the series as well, that we want the octopus to kind of stand there as the ambassadors of, you know, the ocean. And we want our audience to connect with octopuses so that they then can care about their future and the oceans that they live in. And you mentioned, yes, we were so lucky to dive in these beautiful, pristine places. But what we didn't show behind the scenes of some of those sites is the garbage that was in the water. And it was heartbreaking. I remember I came up from one particular dive, and I just felt like it was an apocalyptic world down there. And I started crying, thinking about what are we leaving behind for future generations. I have a daughter, she's 2 years old, and is this what her scuba dives are going to look like everywhere? And I think when you are confronted with that sort of scene, it's really easy to just feel so overwhelmed and being like, well, what can I do? I'm just one single person. But the truth is like our choices as consumers can be really powerful when we band together. And so just think about the choices that you make in your everyday life, how they impact the planet. You know, can you get a product that doesn't have as much plastic, that can be recycled? Can you get a product that's been ethically sourced? Can you write to your local politicians? You know, I care about this. Let's make this change. Because really, it's the big companies that need to make the change. I don't want to put this on every little consumer. It is the big companies. But I think if we band together and we have the power to change our choices, and write to our local MPs, local politicians, then hopefully, you know, my hope is that we'll start seeing change. But I guess the main takeaway from the series is we want you to connect with the octopus. They're ambassadors of our ocean. And research shows that, you know, once we understand something, we grow to love it and we protect what we love.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, and I always encourage people to vote with their dollar, especially in the US and Australia and places where we have that privilege to be able to do that. And it does make business and politicians and things like that pay attention. So now you mentioned your daughter. I have three sons. I teach a lot of students. Dr. Chanel, what advice would you give someone if they wanted to work with marine wildlife?
I would say just get involved. Get involved in, I went into marine science with a very open mind. I wasn't really sure which area I wanted to specialize in. I did lots of different subjects on coral reefs, sustainability, environmental management. I fell in love with behavior and cephalopods. And then I try to just gain as much experience in that and also find a niche of like, what is going to make an impact? What area is really unknown? And I feel like once you find something that you're passionate about, then the rest is magic. Like you don't try and shoehorn your way into an area of, say, marine science, and you're like, oh, well, this is really important because we don't know enough about it. Like just make sure that you're passionate about that area because there's blood, sweat, and tears that go into that, you know, time away from your children, time away from your partner. And so just find a topic that you're passionate about and the rest will work out.
Yes. Well, you are definitely an inspiration. That is for sure. And so for our listeners, Dr. Chanel, is there a way that they can learn more about your research and your lab and your work? Of course, we'll put a link to the Nat Geo Secret of Octopus on our show notes and be promoting that as well. But I didn't know if you had either a website or a social media account where our listeners could follow along with your amazing research and adventures.
Yes, alex.schnell. So that's my Instagram handle. And I'm going to be posting a lot more about the series on there. And then if you go into my profile, I've also linked my website. And then you can also find me on Twitter, or I think it's called X now, at Dr_AlexSchnell.
Awesome. Well, everybody, you should right now have a simple thing you can do for yourselves and for the environment and for Earth Day, Oceans Day, is to follow Dr. Chanel on her Instagram account so you can be updated on all the cool things that she is doing, her team is doing, as well as National Geographic. I love to follow them on social media, all of their wildlife TV series. It's how I stay engaged because I'm not able to be out there in the field. Like you guys are so awesome. But yeah, they'll always update you on what's going on. And then that way you can be a part of it and help stay inspired and help and continue to learn and be just marveled about octopuses and their shape-shifting ability, their mastermind ability, and as Dr. Chanel and her team showed, their social nature. So many secrets revealed in this series by Nat Geo. And Dr. Chanel, I just want to thank you for your time, your inspiration, for what your team is doing, not only for octopuses, but also for the next generation of marine enthusiasts out there, octopus lovers like myself. So thank you. And I hope that in maybe a few years, I'll put it out there to the universe that we'll be back for part two with all the funding that you're going to get to continue to learn more about how octopuses feel and how they think and just putting them out there for the public to fall in love with. So
thank you so much, Angie.
Oh, it's the pleasure is all mine. And so thank you. Have a great time. Enjoy being home for a little bit, probably. And happy Earth Day. And our listeners, once again, check out National Geographic's Secret of the Octopus, which is premiering on Earth Day. So thank you, everyone.
Thanks.
Bye-bye, Dr. Chanel.
Bye.